all types of social events, including weddings, birthday parties, and work gatherings. Details at thearkbowl.com. What the Soap? WTS and Company in Prattsville for soaps and lotions made on site, locally handcrafted candles, pottery, jewelry, art, and gifts, and a hand-picked selection of books on homesteading, nature, and local history. WTS and Company in the Prattsville Plaza and online at whatthesoap.com.
Hi, this is Audie Martello, host of the Catskills Cafe, inviting you to take a seat with me in my virtual coffee house and listen to classic folk, folk rock and bluegrass, new and traditional sounds, plus interviews with indie and established artists. Come and join me every Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. right here on WIOX Roxbury, community radio, live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXRadio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, on smart devices through the Radio FM app, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John's out tonight chasing the almighty white-tailed deer. Hopefully he has one by now. But we got Zane in here tonight. Zane, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good, Ryan. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. What have you been up to?
I took a walk in the woods today, and all I heard was rushing water. All this rain we had in the last day or so, there's a lot of water coming off the mountains. And it was everywhere.
You're not kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of water. Whenever it rains this much in the Catskills, it reminds me of 2011, Irene struck in August, and that was not cool. There was a lot of water going through the supermarket, about 7 feet or more through the supermarket, and it was something to see. But
yeah, this was up in Rochester Hollow, and it's you can see all the river or water coming off the hills there, and it's something you don't really see in the forest too often.
Ah, that's where you went today?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good spot up there.
Yeah.
Nice rock walls. Must have been a nice farm up there at one point. Been hunting myself. Saw my first buck chasing a doe, so things are starting to become more fall-like. And did the mushroom log inoculation last Saturday with John Michelotti of Catskill Fungi. It was a lot of fun. If you're planting trees, you know, people are still planting trees, just remember spacing and don't plant them too deep. And other than that, yeah, plant away. But we still got a few trees to plant, don't we, Zane?
Yeah, we just got some peach trees left. Kind of hangers on. But as long as the ground's not frozen, any time this time of year is great to plant.
And I'm getting members calling saying, you know, they're scared of a tree near their house. Usually it's white pine. I don't blame them. And with all this rain and wind, things can be hazardous, and that's where we got to rely upon people like Ken Palmer, who we're talking to tonight. The Godfather Tree Care, I call him, but Arbor Master with Ken Palmer is tonight's show. He has 30 years of experience as an instructor, coach, speaker, author, researcher, and workforce development consultant for the tree care industry. He's the president of International Champion Techniques, specializes in chainsaw safety and handling, precision tree felling operations, tree climbing, and climbing systems, arborist rigging, rescue systems, trainer training, and much more. Ken is a three-time ISA, International Society of Arboriculture, International Tree Climbing Champion. He has instructed thousands of individuals in best practices and techniques throughout North America, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan. In 2018, Ken was awarded the ISA Alex L. Scheigo Award for Excellence in Arboricultural Education. Let me see if I can get Ken on the phone. Ken, are you there?
Good evening.
Good evening. How you doing?
Very good, Ryan. Nice to meet you, Zane.
Yeah, nice to see you again, Ken. We're here again.
Yeah, we both recently attended Arbor Master's training. I think Zane was there for level one climbing and precision tree felling, and I was there for level two rigging recently.
Ah, well, I could definitely relate to the rushing water, the sound of rushing water out there. Same here.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area over there in Connecticut. I had never been in that portion before. It's nice.
It's all wetlands here in the quiet corner, the northeast corner, and it really handles water well. In other words, we get a lot of rain, but we don't get a lot of flooding, if you will.
Nice.
As long as you don't try to build flat ball fields, you don't have a problem with flooding, right?
Yeah. We don't know where to put our water, Ken. But
you got your fair share, that's for sure.
Absolutely. You know what you got over there? You guys got the biggest wild grapes I've ever seen in my life in that portion of Connecticut. You guys, was there vineyards around there at some point? Concords, wild concords?
All the above over the years. You know, we're in an old part of the country, if you will, with respect to Europeans settling here and bringing their favorite plants and from trees to grapes to blueberries and on and on and on. So, you know, this time of year, while it's sad to see the leaves go, one of the things that really is pretty and really interesting is the depth. The forest changes immensely, the scenery. It's all rolling hills and very rural here. And I love the leaves on the trees, but I also enjoy the depth of the forest and to be able to see into the forest and so on, where we find grist mills and all kinds of old stone structures. We grow rocks here. I reckon you do there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Once those leaves come off, you see all that agricultural legacy, and I'm sure you have a lot more even there because it's just older area. But those wild grapes are huge. I see wild grapes here, but I don't know what's going on there with that variety of Concord. But they're bigger than our cultivated ones here. Crazy.
Interesting.
But I digress. Yeah, I thought about it. I thought about it, but I was too preoccupied with trying to learn everything you guys were teaching me because it's a lot of information. I got to write stuff down. But so from the seas to the trees, Ken. First of all, how did you get into this tree business in such a big way? I mean, what was the first thing that made you say, "Yeah, that's what I want to do"?
Well, I grew up in a rural area around a lot of farms, so I had farms and forest and water and more of that than neighbors, in fact, back in those days. And so I took to building tree houses. My dad had built my older brother and sister a tree house, so by the time I was big enough sprout to follow them around, I was climbing up into the tree house, and it was just something that I grew up with, and I was good at pruning off a dead branch. If my dad had something around he wanted me to do, it was just the natural.
Yeah. Also, yeah.
The seas part, I grew up with boats. We would have every imaginable kind of boat. And then my mom had a yacht that during my later teens, I started to skipper and so forth. But I didn't learn to sail until I was in my early 20s, and that was in Florida. And I had, at the time I was doing tree work, and I was offered a job at a marina commissioning new sailboats. And the Hunter 54 footers were really popular at that time. And I, the fella hired me because he thought I was knacky, and I grew up a doer, you know, kind of a worker, and just a lot of varied experience. I think more than I really even valued at that age, you know. But he told me that I would take to it like a duck to water. Sure enough. So I spent the better part of my 20s rigging and racing sailboats and transporting boats up and down the East Coast.
And how did the two relate to each other, from seas to trees? I watched your video. I thought it was pretty neat. How do the two relate? Rigging on a sailboat, rigging in a tree? I mean, that's a kind of really big question, but give it a try.
When I moved back to the Northeast in my early 30s, I went to work at a marina on the coast of Massachusetts, and because it was, you know, a similar occupation. And in those days, I had foreseen that I would start a business skippering, taking care of boats, working on boats, because I have a woodworking background as well. And it was just a great fit, and I'd learned so much working in Florida that they immediately put me on. It was in right after Labor Day, and they put me on the lift to haul boats right away because the boats were coming out of the water. Unlike my years in Florida, so I hauled about 160 boats with a travel lift, put them on either a trailer or in the yard or in the big building. And then we were hauling the floating docks, and then it was inside for all the finite bright work, you know, the unsung heroes of making those boats look beautiful. But it wasn't for me to be inside. I went back into the tree care industry. And when I did, I began to realize that much of the tools and equipment that arborists were working with were just, well, I thought of Stone Age, because things just hadn't progressed much. Some materials, you could say some technologies like synthetic rope. I learned to climb trees on hemp rope. And the saddles were far cry from what they are today, meaning the harness that we climb with and the fall protection in general. And most was really borrowed from other industries. That's now changed immensely. But I just had a vision because of my years with really no expense was even an issue in rigging sailboats. People will spend a lot of money on their sport. I'm sure you guys have noticed that kind of thing. But certainly in sailing, the technology was just really fascinating. And coming back to tree work, where we're still managing loads, we're handling loads, and we're moving loads, there's so much a connection when it comes to dismantling trees and much of the work that we do that it was a natural. So I had a vision for working with manufacturers and then got into climbing competition. And that helped take me there.
You have something, Zan?
I imagine kind of climbing a mast is kind of like climbing a tree, except that you're either disassembling the mast or you're kind of improving it, pruning it or something.
Installing electronics, taping spreaders on the end so you don't tear sails. There's a lot of things. Also, there's running rigging through the mast. And if someone on deck happens to let go of the halyard, the halyard is what raises the sail, then it may end up at the top of the mast. That means somebody's got to go up and get it, even if you're out at sea.
So, Ken, why is it, what you're saying a bunch of terms that I don't know anything about sailing, but why was it so cavemanish or Stone Age in tree work? I mean, here's something that people fall out of trees, they can die, they can get obviously severely hurt. There is people who care for their trees in more, you know, affluent areas. How come it was not as progressed as other industries at the time?
Well, there's a lot to be said about the changing of time and how things develop, because, as we all know, technique and technology go hand in hand, right? The industry was accustomed to working with what it was accustomed to working with. And another thing I should speak to is the old practice of tree work was known as tree surgery. And it was a very different practice that was not founded in good biology, where we were filling trees with concrete, draining cavities, which ultimately was actually causing the spread of decay. Lots of steel in trees to help hold them together. It was very different than what we do today. And it was Dr. Alex Shigo in the New Tree Biology, the book that he wrote, as well as Modern Arboriculture, and then his teaching. He was a dynamic speaker and teacher with a really interesting history. He came from the U.S. Forest Service, a tenured researcher. And he was actually forbidden to teach compartmentalization of decay in trees. In other words, introducing us to good tree biology, plant biology. And so topping and many of the practices that used to be used, even painting, we were not practicing good tree biology. We would make, flush cuts on trunks. We didn't know we were spreading decay, but then you just paint it, right? And that's just what was done. It was done long before World War II. In fact, Davy Company is probably the oldest running company. Roughly 150 years ago, John Davy came from England. They had an old practice in England of climbing trees. Not so much climbing in mainland Europe in those days, but tree surgery practices. Those things, those horrible things I just mentioned, like filling trees with concrete and lots of steel and so forth. Some of the work was amazing. They learned to work with the way the trees seal, but in those days we thought of trees in such a way as if they would heal. And in the plant kingdom, there is no such thing as healing per se, if we define healing as the replacement of dead, dying, damaged cells. That's sort of reserved for the animal kingdom. So what plants can do, especially trees, is seal, and they work to seal decay, because decay is their arch enemy, decay fungi.
So, Ken, why was Alex Shigo barred from talking about compartmentalization at the time?
Well, think about it. This is going back to the late 70s and early 80s. And this was a well-established practice in U.S. Forest Service and many of his peers. And he was a tenured researcher, so he was an academic. And his publisher perished, right? So overnight, all of that literature, I'll just say, fell deeply under question. So he was ridiculed by many of his peers until the day he died. I can tell you that personally because he was a personal friend of mine. He actually invited me, asked me to come to Europe to help teach how to carry out what he was prescribing. All of their work was tree surgery at that time, and that would have been in the early 90s. He did for them what he did for us early on, but the first time I heard his name was in 1985, and it was the day that my boss told me that we don't have to paint cuts anymore. And it was a glorious day. I think it was the worst part of the job. It was all over everything, including us, you know.
I mean, you know, any industry, you want innovation, I would imagine. Why do you think innovation occurred in the U.S.? You know, I have here in your resume here, it says you teach all over the world. Why do you think that the innovation in tree care, was it because of Alex Shigo? And why doesn't innovation occur in education or technology?
Well,
in your opinion,
Alex changed our practice. He also was good at sowing vision, but I was interested when I first came back to the Northeast back in 1985 in working with better tools. I mean, I had been working with amazing tools and amazing equipment, and I won a couple of world championships, but I got laser focused on climbing competition because I loved it. I was probably natural born show off, you know, and I loved it. But then in 1987 and 88, the international event was called off, or it was postponed. It was put on the shelf because insurance people started to come out and see what we were doing. And oftentimes we were not secured until we reached the top of the tree, where we would then secure ourselves with rope and so forth. And then we would work the tree. It was loosely defined, and tradition was what it was. So a couple of years in thinking it over, the International Society of Arboriculture managed to convince them that if we were tied in all the time, that it would be safe, and they went along with it. So the competition resumed in 1989. I qualified by winning in New England, and that qualified me for the internationals, where I went to compete. And it was a new group of guys. During that 2 years, a lot of the previous competitors that had been returning year after year didn't return. It was like a fresh group. And some of us had mountaineering background as well as more extensive rigging background. And we started to innovate right away. We had to, because the night before the climbing competition, we learned that we were going to have to be secured. And this is the international now. We were going to have to be secured 100% of the time. Hmm. And we're looking at each other going, what? This is not on our radar screen. So it was an interesting example of the competitive events actually driving best practice, because it was not even a best practice standard yet at that time.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in New Paltz, where rock climbing is kind of an industry, and mm-hmm. the Shawangunk Ridge there, or the Gunks, as some people call it, you know, I looked at tree climbing, and I could recognize gear. So how did that influence the tree climbing industry, some of this rock climbing or harnesses, or do I have that wrong? Maybe it came the other way around. I don't really know.
Yeah, the materials probably also had to innovate. You guys probably needed materials with new properties that you were looking for.
Yes, and it was a challenge because we traditionally worked with half-inch rope. And in mountaineering, they were working with much smaller diameter rope. Therefore, the hardware, the great hardware that they were working with, I mean, amazing to us, didn't fit our rope. So we had to cobble together the systems just to make things work. It wasn't until we began working with manufacturers like Buckingham Manufacturing, Sampson Rope Technologies, that we started to build for this industry. So we were probably early on, but other people caught on to that quickly. And other manufacturers caught on to that quickly, that, hey, you need to be working with these guys. So for a young professional arborist that could articulate themselves and work effectively with the manufacturer, it just took off like wildfire. Because, as you know, it's a pretty good-sized industry. There's really three segments: commercial, residential, utility line clearance, and then government, which is quite diversified. I mean, we do training for the U.S. Marine Corps, the Army, the Navy, to municipalities, departments of transportation, and so on and so on. Actually, all three of those segments that I mentioned, commercial, residential, which is private tree companies, utility line clearance, that's fairly obvious to folks. Mostly you see, those are the guys you see the most because they're parked on the side of the road. They're working on distribution. But there's also transmission and many other aspects of each of the segments are quite diversified. It's amazing how many people really interface with the trees and end up having business dealing with trees, because it's about management, right? It's not about harvest. That's not what drives arboriculture or tree care or tree care industry. It's really about the trees that interface with people and trees, where people and trees are trying to survive together, live together. We love trees. But they can also represent a great deal of risk, yet they are a great resource. So it's more about resource and risk than harvesting. That's not what drives the tree care industry.
So I recently wrote an article on Stahl, this quote from a guy, you might know him. If we're going to have an intelligent conversation, we must define the terms, right?
Alex used to say that. He convinced me of that early on.
How would you describe an arborist in your perspective? Because, you know, a lot of people around here, You know, it's like foresters get confused with forest rangers, arborists get confused with a lot of other people, really. So how would you describe it?
Well, we pressed Alex on this some years ago. How would you define an arborist? And there were different definitions. The most succinct would be that an arborist is a tree care professional that can diagnose problems or potential problems, issues with a tree, with a given tree, right, in each individual tree, as opposed to a forest of trees, if you will, though it might be along an edge or so forth. But an arborist is a person that can diagnose potential problems or potential problems.
Okay. Makes sense.
Prescribe treatment and either carry that treatment out or make recommendations for those that can and will.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. What do you think, Zane?
I think the idea of a tree care professional, part of that definition is really important. But yeah, it's about individual trees on the landscape. But I like your point in that it's about interacting with trees, trying to find a balance with them, living with them, sharing that space with them.
That's what we do, unless you're living in the desert, you know.
So, if you're just tuning in, first of all, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Arbor Master with Ken Palmer. So, Ken, you are a tree climbing champion, which is pretty awesome. Three times?
3 times internationally, yes.
And what got you, though, into education, though? I mean, you took it to a totally different level now. So now you're getting into education, and then I want to ask you about your innovation, with your direct innovation with safety protocols and technology. But, you know, some people are really good, you know, basketball or baseball players, but they don't necessarily know how to teach. But you're doing that, and as far as I could see, it's awesome. I mean, I love your training. So, how did that happen?
Well, I had great mentors, but I would say that I was kind of dragged into it. Once I won my first world championship, I was being asked to speak at our trade association meetings and different kinds of events. So I quickly realized that I really didn't know anything about public speaking, and I didn't really even know how to organize myself, but I was a great demonstrator. So I worked with a fellow, Bob Weber, from Pittsburgh area back in those days, and he was a fellow competitor. We met in competition, and the two of us were head-to-head for years at the international level because he did come with mountaineering background. So he was looking at things from that perspective, but was very familiar with working height, also working with trees, but also working with other equipment and looking for other equipment. So we were a natural fit. And he liked to speak, but he was a fellow that liked to read from a script. His dad was an airline pilot, so he kind of grew up that way to organizing himself. And I was a demonstrator, I was the show-off. I was the guy doing the work, and I just loved it. And a couple of years into that, one day his microphone was failing, and mine was up in the tree, mine was working, and I just started to teach and talk. But it was really Alex Shigo, again, that brought us to Europe in 1993 that really put things into another level. Because now we're teaching internationally. We're working through interpreters. Every word had to be chosen well. So it was a lot of experience, really, and then diving into the finer art of adult education.
So maybe to give some of our listeners something to imagine, what would be the kind of minimum equipment you would need to get into a tree? Obviously a rope, but can you describe kind of the minimum equipment that you started out with, or just the formula for it, I guess?
And how does it differ from climbing, rock climbing as well, maybe, too?
Yeah, I'll go back to the very minimum. Start there. It was just a piece of rope, where we'd tie a double bone on a bite, leave a tail, and that was our climbing hitch. And it was all one rope system. And then, and we didn't have pads in those days, we had calluses, right? And then we moved into saddles that were very crude and so forth. So it was very removed from the sport climbing. It really wasn't until international climbing competition where it began to happen on a big level. And that was because we had to figure out how to get our line to the top of the tree so that we could work on rope all the time. We wanted to win climbing competitions, and we wanted to work, make our work safer and easier. We loved the idea, but we had to figure it out. So those were very, very fortunate days for the tree care industry, the way things played out and took place. And, of course, manufacturing was at a different level. Metallurgy was at a different level. Rope technology, synthetic ropes, were at a whole different level. And it was I look back at my life many times, and I realize the timing. Timing and vision.
What do you think has been the biggest improvement in technology that's maybe changed the tree climber's life in the tree, you think?
Well, it depends on what you're doing in the tree, right? I guess I would have to start with synthetic rope.
Yeah.
And also far better harnesses, saddles. A lot of people think of horses when you say saddle, but oftentimes in the tree care industry, we refer to a climbing harness or fall protection systems. The basic harness we put on is a saddle. It's a little different because harnesses can mean different things in different industries.
Yeah.
It was a process. It was such a process. It's hard to say because it all works together.
Right.
I could say chainsaws, lighter chainsaws. I could say great handsaws, connecting links, carabiners, aluminum rather than steel, everything being steel and rope snaps and so forth, but many, many, many things.
It's just changing so fast. I mean, I took that Arbor Master Climbing 1 with Rip maybe 8 to 10 years ago, and it's changed a lot since then.
Yes.
A lot.
Interestingly, while the industry, the tree care industry, traditionally had really been borrowing even tools from other industries, if you will, what's happening now is what the development going on in the tree care industry now will affect all of those other industries. Single rope technique is what's primarily used in mountaineering. Unless it's a top rope on a rock wall kind of a thing. The traditional method of working on rope for arborists was doubled rope, where the rope would be passed over the limb and then both parts brought back to us, and we would go up and down one side. We had mechanical advantage. It made work easier. Realized that on rock walls, buildings, and these other industries, they're hundreds of feet up. They need long rope. So doubled rope is not even an option. Single rope. However, to ascend was one set of equipment. It always has been traditionally. To descend is another set of equipment. And that changeover from one to the other is where the human error factor comes in and causes more injuries than everything else put together. Hmm. So even our high-angle rescue people with the fire department, very, very few are taught to climb. They're taught to establish an anchor from above and descend to. So that's an issue for tree climbers, right? Because emergency response comes even with high-angle rescue experience, it doesn't mean that they're going to know how to get a rope in the tree and get to the victim.
So what's really changed over time, sorry to cut you off, but it seems like what's really changed over time is the technology, the materials. But for me, what was most interesting is just the knot tying itself, the kind of fundamentals. And that seems more to me like a skill rather than a technology or piece of equipment, something you have to kind of internalize and learn.
Right. The skill goes with everything because it's all about doing. You know, knowing, understanding, having insights, you can read all you want, but until you do it, you don't know how to do it. Or, you follow me? And then we go into, if we continue and we practice, we can develop competence. And then further on to proficiency. Because that's how it works. I cannot train another human being in all reality. We train by doing. Whatever we do again and again is what we train ourselves to do, for better or for worse.
What kind of mindset, Ken, do you think someone should have getting into, tree climbing, tree care, whatnot, to make it safe and productive? Is there a certain mindset you think someone should try to?
Do you mean for a climber or generally speaking?
Generally speaking, I mean, I feel like, I don't know. I remember you were the precision tree felling. You were talking about being safe and just not being in harm's way. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty cool, because you can't get hurt if you're not in the way, I feel like safety, often we talk about the technology, but there's also a mindset of safety too, I feel.
Oh, yes. Safety, skill, and productivity go together hand in hand.
Yeah.
They really do. So the mindset, well, it's hard work, but it's good work. And some of us grew up with it. For myself, I wanted to work on the farms around me because it was a lot of fun, and there was a lot of little benefits, like you could drive the trucks and the tractors, and you could drive the Jeep. We had a Jeep we could use in the evening, but we had to feed the cows, throw it on the silage, help with the hay, help bale hay, a lot of things we did. And I wanted to hang with the older guys, so I had to be able to prove myself. And where you gain respect was to be useful, So that kind of thing, I think, predisposes a person to really come to appreciate the work of their own hands and really understand what skill is.
Also, imagine it takes a little bit of humility. If somebody has a better way of doing something, it's being humble enough to know that, to take that on, to learn from that person.
In life, a great skill is to be able to embrace change. It's a constant. So if we're not skillful at being able to embrace change, then we're going to be left behind in life, in everything. And I usually suggest to people criteria, especially in the old days when a lot of people would see what we were doing and say, what do you need that stuff for? They just didn't get it. They were just kind of set in their own little ways kind of thing. And I would say, well, if this has the potential of making your work safer and easier and more efficient, does that not make sense?
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
You decide. But be teachable.
Right.
One of the things I found interesting in your course was that many knots are in these books that we can use when we're on the ground before we get into the tree, but some of the knots aren't in the books, and some of those knots that aren't in the books are ones you might prefer in a given situation. So that's another reason to kind of be in a community of learners when you're learning about this stuff, because you might learn something that's not in the book just from exchanging information. So
that's,
to your point.
That's another connection with Seeds to the Trees. By the way, there's a video on YouTube, Arbor Master Seeds to the Trees. I think anybody would enjoy it. It's short. It's a sort of a story, but the knot tying, the knots and marlin spike seamanship I grew up with. So that was a natural fit. But the reality is that in application, many of the knots that you would think of, like a bowline, for example, that's something that most people have heard of, maybe familiar with. There's a whole family of bowlines, and it depends on the application. So again, it's back to skill and situational awareness.
Yeah. Situational awareness. That's a tough one, because you've talked to guys who are been climbing a long time, and sometimes you just unbuckle yourself, right, Ken?
No.
No, but I've been talking to guys who've been doing it a long time, and somehow that happens, and that would be a lack of situational awareness. That's that mindset again, I guess. I don't know.
Well, a person can get frustrated moving through the branches and the canopy of a tree and see that it might be an easier maneuver to just unhook and go reach over that limb and grab the rope back.
Right.
but they're also moving their position in the process, and they can slip, and gravity is relentless.
Yeah. It's humbling, that's for sure. Especially afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, some people say you've got to fear heights. I don't have a fear of heights. Fortunately, I think that is something that I overcame. I'm not saying that it's not a natural. It's a very natural thing, that fear. I mean, that anxiety that you get when you're not accustomed to that environment. But I do have a very healthy respect.
I can attest to that. When I first got into the tree, you know, your adrenaline's going. All these chemical reactions are happening in your body that you can't control. You might be distracted. You're looking at things that don't matter. You're not focused on what's in front of you. When I first did it the first day, my leg wouldn't stop shaking. I found surprising that the next day it did stop shaking, and then I got a little bit more confidence to get higher up into the tree. Felt a little bit different, but it's surprising what you can learn just by immersing yourself in it.
To get past those elements of vertigo that are very natural and very normal. It's about pushing through, leaning in. It's akin to seasickness in a lot of ways. As you can imagine, I teach sailing, so I'm always watching the crew and making suggestions for those that might be looking a little green around the gills. But I usually begin talking about that before we go.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is Arbor Master with Ken Palmer. We're going to take a break, and we got some more questions for Ken next. Just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. We're talking to Ken Palmer from Arbor Master over in Connecticut. Time's flying. We only have about 12 minutes left in the show. That was Todd Rundgren. I don't know how to say his last name. Do you?
I don't know.
Come on. Ken?
I never looked that song.
Jod Rundgren.
Oh, there you go.
There we go. So, Ken, we're running out of time here. You can take it any direction you want, but, you know, looking in the mirror and into the future, I mean, how are things looking in the industry of arboriculture in the U.S. compared to other areas and whatnot?
Well, here in southern New England, we can date the age of the forest. Now, I should qualify that. But we can date the age of the forest as a very general statement back to the hurricane of 38. Now, obviously, in the other side of forestry, our compadres that are involved in harvest, that's another matter altogether, right? The cycles and the way that the trees are grown and harvested at given times and so forth, landowners and what they do. But those trees that are just growing there along the side of the road and our yards and wherever that are not harvested on purpose and so forth, unless it's cut down for some reason or falls down, they're older trees. We have an older forest. So if anything, there's more and more and more need for management all the time.
I agree with that. Yeah, that's happening in the Catskills as well, for sure.
Yeah. And I could give you a bunch of examples of that in aerial lift companies and how they started to put elevators underneath of, some time ago now, finally. Rather than building the truck to reach high to begin with, they started bringing them back in and putting lifts under the turret, scissors lifts, and different kinds of raising platforms to get higher in the trees. It's like we forget that these trees keep on growing. You know, unless it's something that you're kind of faced with all the time, and it speaks to what you said early on in the show about don't plant too deep and don't plant too close. Alex preached that, and he was probably the one that pushed that into the public understanding more than anyone, but it's not a natural thing for us to spatially be able to envision this nice, cute little tree that we're planting and what it's going to be like years later. They keep growing, and they keep growing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do need care. They do need maintenance. They need someone who's going to be willing to work in on or around them, as you say in your courses.
Yeah, it's really about management because we need to manage those large sources of potential energy around us because they can be hazardous to life, limb, and property.
What are some of the biggest challenges arboriculture is facing now, and what are some of the biggest innovations you see in the horizon?
Well, there's a lot happening with mini lifts and minis in general. We like every industry, has a real challenge with workforce and workforce shortages. So workforce development is huge, and that, of course, is the industry that we're in as educators and trainers. it stands to reason that equipment that is, I mean, not just the climbing equipment, you know, the minis, like mini skid steers, mini excavators, many, these little devices that can fit through your fence and actually then stand up and you can reach 70 feet in the air and so forth. Even the people that work on the ground, it used to be that we always tried to get the chipper as close to the tree as possible, right? Because you don't want to drag the brush any further than you have to. It's hard work dragging brush and wood. But with the little mini skid steers that a lot of tree companies are using now, leave the chipper on the street, keep the noise out there and so forth, and the minis could come in, and you can pile the brush in the minis and take them out. So it's really also a response by tree company owners to invest in equipment because the equipment's there every single day. You just need somebody to run it, and it can cut down on the need for how many people you have and so forth. But there's always going to be a huge need for young people in the tree care industry, and that's for sure. Similar things happening abroad. It would vary country by country. We could spend easily the rest of our time talking about the countries that I work in and have worked in and have colleagues in and so forth. And it depends a lot on their economic status for sure. In Mexico, Central, South America has been a tough one for us because economically and traditionally, it just hasn't been. Trees are taken for granted, and people free climb them, pick coconuts, and lots of things. It's been tough to really make a huge impact. But recently, we've partnered with an organization that's franchised in 9 countries in Mexico, Central, South America, La Casa del Arborista. And so they're successfully doing business and are growing their equipment supplies as well as their educational programs. Now we can partner with them and make an impact there for safe tree climbing and tree work. So I've had the chance to work in, just going backwards, you know, in Japan, before that was Australia, New Zealand, and before that was Western Europe. And each has its own place in terms of where it is. But clearly the United States, and I would say now Western Europe and even Japan, Australia, New Zealand, are really where they need to be. They're coming along nicely. Of course, that's an ongoing process technologically. And as I said earlier, technology and technique drive each other. Sometimes the technology is allowing us to do things that we couldn't do before. And sometimes the technique or the desire to be able to use certain techniques are what drive the technology. Like I said earlier, so much development is taking place in our industry now, which is a complete turnaround for me from 25, 30 years ago where we were borrowing from other industries. Now the development is going on in our industry because manufacturers take us seriously. It's a serious industry.
So I see New Jersey licensed arborists, I think, 2014. What do you think? Do you think that's a good idea?
Licensing, well, when it comes to standards, licensing, certification, in general, there's different purposes for different things. But you asked specifically about a New Jersey license. It depends on how it's conducted. Yeah. Here in the state of Connecticut, the Connecticut Tree Protection Association really put together the certification, but then gave it to the Department of Natural Resources to oversee it. So there's really no one to oversee that these things are actually being followed out there. So more laws is not always the answer. Standards like the ANSI standard, the American National Standards Institute, it's a consensus standard. It oversees the process for any group to come together and wrestle through a true cross-section of industry, all stakeholders represented, ideally, to wrestle through matters of best practice and to keep a standard that is current. It's not a cutting-edge standard. It's more reactionary, and you could say a rising tide lifts all boats, right? That's the idea, because a lot of people are not cutting-edge. It's not their focus, but the standards can be helpful if those standards are updated and kept current. OSHA oftentimes falls way behind in their standards, even with the utility line clearance standard, because there's no real precedent for mandatory update for those standards. Whereas with an ANSI standard, every 5 years, there has to be a comprehensive update of the standard and revision. And it's a process that's overseen by the ANSI executive. So I'm more a believer in best practice, education, training, mentoring, coaching, and that sort of thing than I am laws. We got so many laws. How many of them are really being observed or enforced?
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't understand that ANSI exists. So who sits on these ANSI boards and stuff?
Well, I did my 20 years. I was asked to represent the International Society of Arboriculture back in 1997. And in those days, we were, well, I'll just say that the old gray-haired guys on the standard, they knew me. They knew who I was. But I represented a whole new generation. And that was a process, and it still is a process. So, again, ideally, it's a cross-section of industry, and the voting group is well-chosen, you know, by the Secretariat. And that is updated as well. So it's not a situation where it's the ideal perfect scenario, because I don't think we're perfect, you know, and it's an ongoing process of trying to keep it real.
Yeah, I agree with you about the education component and mentorships. Those are really important. Those are kind of very rigorous, and they're very, I guess, they're hard to, they don't give away as easily as a law might. Someone can change a law the next day, but something like education that stays with a person, and that person can take that and spread that to someone. So that's kind of a bottom-up way of looking at it, and really strong for the industry as a whole.
We can spend a lot of time telling people what to do and what not to do. In fact, when I drive down the road, I see all kinds of signs, especially on the highway. There's a speed limit sign. And if I try to drive the speed limit, I become a road hog.
Right.
In other words, we don't follow laws that well. And unfortunately, many company owners and organizations don't value or don't, in terms of a commercial company, oftentimes have a budget for or a business plan that includes workforce development. That's an ongoing thing today more than ever with workforce shortages and more technological equipment that we're working with. It's essential.
Yeah, it's about creating a space where innovation can be cultivated organically. That's where it really sticks around and persists through time, I think.
Yes, developing a culture. It's not, you know, one and done, or can you fix those guys over there? You know, it's really a process, and we like to engage our clients in workforce development. In other words, think about the big picture. Step back and look at your longer-term objectives. We can achieve objectives if we define them and work at them.
Well, Ken, believe it or not, we are out of time. You believe this?
Just getting started.
I could talk definitely for another hour. Ken, thank you for taking the time out of your night and coming on From the Forest.
You're very, very welcome. It was fun, and my hat's off to you guys for what you're doing. It looks cool, and you guys obviously work hard to put everything together and make it easy for your speakers like myself.
Well, we appreciate that, and thank you for all that you do.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ken.
I just want to say, you guys, because I know you guys climb, and for those that out there that do or are thinking about it or have a mind to, climb safe.
That's right.
Climb safe. Well, rig it right. If you're in, we'll see you.
Tie your own knots.
At the top.
All right. Thank you, Ken. Hey, have a good night.
Okay, you as well, guys.
Yep.
All right, if you just missed the show, that was Ken Palmer from Arbor Master over in Connecticut, and have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long-forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside. town.